From Buffalo Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next Producers Picks, highlights of a conversation heard on a previous episode. On today's show,
if we're going to redefine and change a community and build up people in a community that have oftentimes been long disenfranchised and under-resourced, we've got to start pulling in funding and delivering and creating programs within said community to address just some of their needs.
Alex Burgos, public health policy and public relations professional. And we close with,
and by root causes, we meant causes of all of the other issues that Black people face. Causes that triggered other problems and other difficulties.
Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr., the director of the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at the University at Buffalo. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. First, we revisit my conversation with Alex Burgos. We speak on how to fill the gaps in youth and sports programs on Buffalo's West Side and how to develop policies to increase accessibility to programs. You know, we ran into each other about a month ago at a fundraiser. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Therese and Audrey and everyone at the Elmwood Village Association. You had mentioned wanting to come back on the show.
Yeah.
Now you're here.
I sure am.
And you've been working on more than a few things.
Yeah.
But at the top of that list is filling the gaps in youth and sports programs on Buffalo's West Side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, thank you again for having me back, first and foremost. It's been about a year since I've been back, and, you know, the work has continued, and my work has evolved in a multitude of ways. And as I continue to grow, not only in my line of work and in my community engagement, I've identified more needs in speaking with stakeholders and continue to collaborate with community partners like the Bell Center, who are an amazing and tremendous resource and, quite frankly, a lifeline on Buffalo's Lower West Side. There's a lot more work to do. And I think that the opportunities that we set up for our youth to be successful, the opportunities we present for them to engage in different activities, and the investment that we deliver to our neighborhood really sets the precedent and the tone of what kind of city we're going to create going forward for the next generation to come.
Yeah, and it's important to having active kids. Mm-hmm. How were you alerted to this issue of gaps within youth programs and sports programs, and what does this problem stem from?
Well, there's a few different things that my advocacy work in that area stems from. Mm-hmm. I used to do youth programming, and right. I still do community programming year-round at this point on a monthly basis, sometimes even more. And I saw the way that oftentimes inner-city programs were underfunded, particularly as it served West and East Side communities. And it's something that's always been in the back of my mind. And in doing policy work towards health equity and addressing a multitude of needs in these communities on the Lower West Side and the Grant West Ferry area and so forth, I've understood that health equity goes beyond just the policy. It goes beyond just the actual health resources that we offer to our communities. It stems into overall wellness. It stems mm-hmm. into opportunity. It delves into areas like housing, but it also delves into things like youth programming. And if you look at census blocks and neighborhoods on the West Side, the Lower West Side community is a neighborhood, according to the U.S. Census, that has the highest concentration of poverty in the entire city.
Wow.
The fourth is the Upper West Side, not too far away from it. And oftentimes, if we're going to redefine and change a community and build up people in a community that have oftentimes been long disenfranchised and under-resourced, we've got to start pulling in funding and delivering and creating programs within said community to address just some of their needs. Now, that's only the tip of the iceberg. Mm-hmm. So I've, you know, been working with the Bell Center for a long time now. They've been a really great community partner of mine. I've done a number of things with them, such as bringing vaccine clinics there, hosting job fairs, you know, doing community programs and panels there. And part of it is my way of pouring back into a community that has poured back into us for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I reached out to the Buffalo Sabres, and we're having some extensive conversations about what investment in our community looks like, right? What it looks like on the West Side for the various diverse communities that we serve.
What might that look like?
Well, you know, we've had a series of long conversations, particularly focusing for now on the Hispanic community on the West Side in particular, and we've grouped together a number of stakeholders and organizations like the Hispanic Women's League, El Bata, the Hispanic Heritage Council, and a number of other organizations. And we've had stakeholders meetings to discuss what a long-term collaborative partnership looks like, not only between the organizations themselves, but the community, mm-hmm. right? And we're making a lot of really great progress. We have a viewing party at the Pucho Olivencia Community Center coming up. And, you know, one of the first things that we are talking about as an initiative is starting something like a youth sports program on the Lower West Side, most likely being held at the Bell Center. And a lot of that, what we came to the conclusion that that was a good starting point is not only data driven, but is community informed. If we look at the data, on average, when we're looking at sports equity in youth and youth programming, youth who come from underserved communities on average only have exposure and the opportunities to play two sports, those mm-hmm. sports being basketball and football.
Right.
And if you go outside to more affluent communities, the average number is six sports.
Wow.
Now that's the average number.
Yes.
That's a combination of the low end and the high end. In our community, that's the average of the low end and the high end. And that average is two. So if you're looking at it, in many communities, there may be one sport mm-hmm. or one program or one initiative that our youth have the opportunity to be part of. And in some cases, there may be none at all.
And so, and it goes beyond sports as well. Just, I mean, we could be talking like art classes. We could be talking like theater. Mm-hmm. We could be talking all of these different things. And we're not talking in-school activities. We are talking extracurricular activities outside of the school system. Talking about the Bell Center Youth Hockey Program and just developing these ties is kind of what you do on a state level,
yes.
correect? That's
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
With policy and advisory work geared mm-hmm. towards health and public safety. I wanted to really quickly circle back to something that you said off air mm-hmm. about the talent
yes.
in the black and brown communities in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
What was the quote? That there's a number of talent?
There's an infinite amount of talent in our communities.
Yes. It's,
you know, and I see it every. I live on the West Side. I know the families there.
Mm-hmm.
We have so much talent, but we don't have enough opportunity or access.
It's
That's
important.
The fine line.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, when you're looking at a community as diverse as the West Side, when you're looking between several factions of different neighborhoods, you're walking this fine line of having folks who have a lot of access and those who don't, sometimes living on the same block.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so the responsibility collectively as people, you know, that I work towards every day is how do we not only bring visibility and opportunity and access for those folks who have less access than us, but how do we get them to where they want to be? And how do we get them to where they need to be, right? That's just as crucial. And in order to do that, you not only have to be data informed,
mm-hmm.
policy informed, you have to be community informed. You have to get their input. You have to bring their voices to the table. And so oftentimes when I'm doing policy work at the state level, I'm not doing it by myself because no one person has all of the answers. And I think the best way to create the best policy at the state level, at the local level, or wherever you're advocating is to not only get access to those rooms, but when you have the door open up, leave that door open, right?
Yes.
Bring those who are, you know, experiencing said disparity that you're trying to address. Bring those who are working at organizations or organizers who are experts in that field and are working to address said issues of whatever it is that you're trying to address, whether it be health equity, public safety, and so forth. And so I kind of see my policy work as a sphere of all the things that need to come together in order to move the needle forward in not only the most effective way, but the most inclusive way.
Okay. What keeps you grounded in your work? I mean, do you ever sleep?
I get that question all the time. I do sleep. I'll confirm that on air. I won't say it's with both eyes, but I do. But, you know, this is my passion. This is, I mean, the guiding force behind everything I do is the community that I live in, the community that I serve. But I think that in life, if you've ever been down, there's so much value in getting a helping hand, right? Mm-hmm. And I myself, in my personal life, I've been down many times, right? I've experienced a lot of the same things as the people that I'm serving. And so I want the outcomes for my community to be different overall, you know, and I myself, to get to the point that I'm at today, I've had to defy every odd. I've had to beat every statistic. And I don't think that my community should have to go through the hurdles that I've experienced.
That's a good point. You're already in the community, but you can go from neighborhood to neighborhood and say, you know, I'm where I am because of this community, mm-hmm. and I am more than what others, outsiders, may think of mm-hmm. the community.
Yes.
Health equity and public safety go hand in hand.
They sure do.
Can you be specific on that?
Well, I've worked, you know, in the realm of health equity and public safety for quite some time in working with stakeholders and policymakers to reimagine what that looks like in our region. You know, when COVID first came out, I had served on a number of task forces and in collaboration with different community organizations to do things like PPE distribution, to do things like community outreach, to do things to make sure that applications and forms were language accessible to folks whose English was not their first language. And that continued as well during the outbreak of monkeypox, when I served on a task force under the health commissioner, and we did that same work directed towards monkeypox in championing for things like language access during the process, getting vaccine clinics rolled out on the east and west side of Buffalo.
Critically important.
Yes, you know, and continuing to not only advise but influence policy to make sure that these rollouts were as effective as possible, but also as culturally responsive as possible. During the Mpox vaccine rollout, at the height of it, I actually also got to do an interview and speak with Dr. Peter Hotez, who at the time was a White House correspondent for the Mpox outbreak, and he was also a nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Wow.
So I've taken guidance not only from the community, but also from folks who are working all the way at the federal level to effectively deliver right here back at home.
That's very impressive. How supportive are the politicians and business leaders you meet with on this topic? You mentioned that you come in, but you're not coming alone. You're not coming alone to these conversations. You've got a seat at the table for yourself, but you are creating seats for the people in your community.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And you know, I'll take one example is last summer we had met with Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado on the west side on Niagara and Hudson, you know, to talk about the needs of the community and ways that we can get to where we need to go as a community and continue to partner as stewards of the community in partnership with his office. And in that conversation, you know, I include community partners I've worked with. I include folks who work in the legal realm, folks who work in social work. And in many of the other conversations that I have with our state agencies or elected officials, I'm always making sure that I'm bringing more voices. I live by this motto that when a door opens for you, you got to leave it open for others. Mm-hmm. And I was recently told in a Facebook comment, and I'm going to change my quote now because of that, that when the door opens for you, you got to kick that door so a door isn't there anymore.
Ah, I like that.
So, you know, I think at the end of the day, the message comes down to making sure that we have a diverse slew of perspectives that are incorporated at policy levels, at decision-making tables, so we can effectively serve a number of diverse communities.
What do you love about your community? What do you love about your West Side community? What do you love about the city of Buffalo?
I could write a book about that.
You should. Think about it.
You know, the West Side, it's where so many of my childhood memories are. Mm-hmm. You know, between being the same little boy that was at my father's shop on Niagara and Hudson to being the same little boy that was at the after-school program and the summer program at Westside Community Services to visiting family that lived all over the community to many of my friends living in the community to going to restaurants in the community, that all of my experiences there shape who I am today. Mm-hmm. And I am built. I'm proud to be a product of said community. I'm proud to be a product of the Buffalo Public School System. I'm proud to be the product of a blue-collar, middle-class family, you know, of a father who was a small business owner and a U.S. Army veteran, and a mother who was a BPS teacher teaching bilingual special needs students in the Buffalo Public School System.
Wow.
And so my life and my upbringing are the very driving force of the work that I went into. It was formulative of the purpose that I have and the work that I can deliver on behalf of a community that I see as an honor to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I could go on and on about my love for the West Side and seeing, you know, how even more diverse it's becoming and how more diverse it continues to become over the years and change, seeing...
It's the driving force in the population rise.
Yes.
The city of Buffalo. Amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I think that the West Side in particular is not only representative of the entire population in the city, you know, under the three major planning neighborhoods in the West Side. I think it's representative of, quite frankly, the population of, you could argue, the whole country.
Right on. That's very well put. Yes. Yes. The diversity on the West Side is really something to behold, and you're really not going to find it anywhere else in the city, in this region.
Yeah.
I wanted to circle back. Where do you see this partnership with the Sabres going? Like, where would you like to see it 5 years from now?
I think, you know, I have a lot of community partnerships with different organizations and stakeholders, and I'd like at some point to bring many of them together. Mm-hmm. Into one room where we can reimagine and redefine the future of the West Side collectively, to get private sector buy-in, to get nonprofit buy-in, to get, you know, foundational buy-in, bringing our community stakeholders together to not only address a multitude of needs that we can only address by being in the same space together on a unified agenda, but really moving the needle forward for the entire community. So I continue to partner with them alongside a number of partners individually, but it is my aspiration to bring them all together and collectively be unified for my vision for the community.
Now, I've talked to a lot of stakeholders over the last 5 years, and I want your opinion on this. Are we at a point in the city of Buffalo where a lot more people are stakeholders, community leaders, politicians we are becoming unsiloed? It's not these groups here or over here,
right,
or over here saying, mm-hmm, we're doing this and we need this. There's a lot more collaboration,
yes,
between organizations and stakeholders in the, mm-hmm, city. You agree with that?
I do. And, you know, I work with a pretty wide network of folks, not only throughout other parts of the city, but other parts of the county and, quite frankly, the state. And I think that something that's revolutionized that is social media.
Right.
It is the digital age,
mm-hmm,
you know, and what came of COVID was the implementation of remote work, Zoom becoming the standard and normal. I mean, before the pandemic, I knew very few people that knew how to do Zoom. Mm-hmm. Everyone just had meetings in person.
Right.
And so now, you know, with different stakeholders, even on the state level, I now can meet more frequently because this is the norm. Before, it would be, hey, you know, I'm going to Albany. Let's coordinate a meeting. Or, hey, I'm coming to Buffalo. Can you give me a tour? Or can mm-hmm. we meet and talk, you know, about ways we can work together? And I feel over the past few years, things have become much more streamlined. You know, you're seeing groups who have entirely different missions working together. You're seeing people of entirely different backgrounds working together. And I'm proud to be a steward of that changing tide in the city.
Pulling those resources together is only going to benefit, in my opinion, the city overall.
Yes.
So do you think you will continue in the advocacy realm for the next few years, or will you take another route? I know you had mentioned off air that, you know, it's all about timing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that however this evolves, I'm going to continue to do this work because
right.
this is who I am. This is my life force. I mean, it's the community that I serve every single day. And, you know, that however that evolves or shifts, the work's going to continue to get done. So I'm really excited for what the future holds and to see how this work continues to evolve and, you know, the role that I take going forward in moving our community forward.
That was Alex Burgos. And we close out with Jay Moran sitting down with Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr., the director of the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at the University at Buffalo. The two discussed two reports that Dr. Taylor worked on, How We Changed the Black East Side and The Harder We Run, the state of Buffalo in 1990 and the present, and how the community can benefit from the changes presented in them.
We had you on not long ago when you came back and reviewed to a certain extent, because the report did come out in 2021, The Harder We Run, the state of Buffalo in 1990 and the present, and that, of course, detailed extensively about the conditions of Buffalo's East Side and how people are living, what really has happened, how actually in many cases conditions have actually decreased and deteriorated over 3 decades. Now, a new report from you, it's How We Change the Black East Side. And I'm most certainly looking forward to getting into this. Let's start with an overview from you. What are the key facts? What are the key realities that play into this framework for changing the East Side?
Yeah, when we took a look at the history of Black Buffalo over the last 30 years, we wanted to know two things. Number one, what happened? What are the conditions that continuously breed the challenges facing the African-American population? And secondly, what were the cause of these issues and challenges? And thirdly, why had the intervention strategies that had been utilized in the past failed? So we found that there were a series of root causes. And by root causes, we meant causes of all of the other issues that Black people face. Causes that triggered other problems and other difficulties. Among these root causes were the residential segregation of Blacks, not just the segregation of Blacks, but their containment in underdeveloped spaces where neighborhood and community wealth were continually extracted from the neighborhoods and the communities, and that they were constantly faced with displacement. A lot of this happens because Blacks do not own or control the land on which their communities are being built. But by wealth extraction, I'm talking about the charging of high rents
right.
For substandard housing. I'm talking about the pandemic of foreclosures on these communities, the high prices that are charged for shoddy goods, the high prices that people pay for house and automobile insurance. And I'm also talking about the extensive fines and fees that are rendered by the government on the populations that exist in these neighborhoods and communities. And so this is what we mean by the problem of wealth extraction, or the problems of displacement reflected in how Black people are continuously pushed out of neighborhoods the moment that speculators and landowners believe that they can make greater profits. So, for example, many of the Black neighborhoods along Buffalo's Main Street corridor are being emptied out. Many of the neighborhoods that are clustered around downtown, people are being pushed outside, out of those neighborhoods. And everywhere where communities are located around anchor institutions or other places that have the potentiality of being transformed from low profitability to high profitability, neighborhoods and communities are in trouble. So this is what we mean by this problem of wealth extraction and the problems of displacement, housing and the like. And these were the issues that African American people were facing. And we said, well, why? Why is this the case? And we saw that this was very much related to the way we build cities in Buffalo, that we set aside spaces where low-income populations and groups, and especially the African-Americans, the Latinx and others, live so that they can live in these areas. And these marginalized, underdeveloped, and undervalued places are essential for the creation of high-value places like Clarence.
Because just to add to this, because we talked about this before we go on the air, that if there are places that are considered undesirable by the wealthier, more affluent populations, and there are places where they can go and be separate from that, that makes those places that much more valuable.
It makes those places that much more valuable. I mean, if we look at the model of home ownership in the United States, that model is based on the commodification of shelter, turning shelter into something that you buy and sell. And the use of the home, owner-occupied home, as an instrument of wealth production. That model requires policies of exclusion, where you design projects, programs, and activities to keep out people based on income and people based on race, because of the linkage between income and race, and rising property values. Those are models of exclusion, models of exclusion. So what we have found in Buffalo is that the whiter and more exclusive a community is, values go up. The blacker and more inclusive a community is, values go down.
And just to clarify one key point here, because you talked about how the white middle-class individual is really pretty much trained that your house, your home, is going to be your source for wealth. This is that model. That model cannot work on Buffalo's east side.
I mean, no, it can't work. It can't work there. And the reason it can't work there is because the value of those houses and the value of those units will never approximate the value of the other locations and places. Not only that, but even if it could work for a handful of people.
A handful, right.
Even if it could work, it's an exclusion model. It's an exclusion model based on individual wealth. So we flip that model by talking about shared ownership and the building of community wealth. Because and the central idea is, can we commodify shelter? And by that I mean to say, the moment you commodify shelter, what you're saying in actuality, that a certain segment of the population, a significant segment of the population, are forced to live in dilapidated and rundown housing. That's the reality. That's the reality. So we think we can alter and change that model. And this isn't to say that one is opposed to home ownership
right.
and individual wealth production. That's fine. But at the same time, what we are opposed to is the creation of neighborhoods and communities where people are forced to live in dilapidated and rundown housing. And that's what this particular model calls for. And I say it calls for that because everybody knows that under the present system of housing valorization, the value of a house is not based upon the parcel, but based upon the neighborhood and the community. So you exclude people from the community in order to increase property values. What we're saying is let's create a very different model. And now instead of emphasizing individual ownership, we're emphasizing shared ownership so that the people who live inside those neighborhoods and communities control and own the land on which their community is built. And that we emphasize community wealth accumulation rather than individual wealth accumulation, because community wealth accumulation allows us to generate wealth that can be utilized on behalf of the entire community. And by utilization on behalf of the entire community, I'm talking about the creation of surpluses that will allow us to reduce other levels of cost. Let me give you a concrete example.
Please.
We were talking the other day with Pastor Pointer, who's heading up the food co-op that they're developing on the Buffalo's East Side. And one of the things that the pastor emphasized is that we will have investors, but we will not be paying dividends to these investors. Instead, we will use the surpluses to reduce the cost of food and raise the income of the people who work in the store. In this way, you pass on the profits that are being produced to the consumers rather than people who have invested across the time. And those investors recoup by being able to purchase lower priced goods and services in the store that they have helped to build and create. So this is a classic example of how we use surplus community wealth in order to build stronger, better, and healthier neighborhoods and communities.
And also, it's worthwhile as we say this, just to also make another clarification here, the affordable housing models that we're seeing, different developments being built in different parts of the city, including in the East Side, that current affordable housing model as that stands does not work inside what you are talking about here.
Right. The affordable housing model is very problematic as we use it. It's a model driven by the utilization of low-income tax credits, and it is supposed to be targeted for people at the bottom of the income order. But the developers have learned how to circumvent that. And many of these houses, especially now, are being flooded on Buffalo's East Side, especially in the Broadway Fillmore area, which I believe, based on our research and analysis, is one of the prime targets of gentrification in the city of Buffalo. But many of these houses will cap rents at around 60% of the median household income, which equates to people who are making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year, and it becomes very, very affordable for them. I know recently when we looked at market rate housing for a one-bedroom apartment for 2023, it was around $964 a month. And people will say, wow, that's really, really great. But when you run the numbers, you see problems.
Right.
For a person to afford that, they got to be making about $3,600 a month or around $40,000 a year. Not bad, but about 54% of African Americans make less than $40,000 a year. Around 32 to 33% make less than $20,000 a year. So that's too high. So if it's going to be affordable for the black and brown and immigrant populations, you got to do something like Elaine Brown did in Oakland, California. Build units where that are catered to people making around 30% or less than the medium area household income. So that's a part of the issue. The other part of the issue is that many of the people who are advocating these units are seeing that as a solution to the severe housing problems faced by African Americans, and I would also say the Latinx and immigrant populations. But that's not the case. You've got to fix the housing that people are currently living in. You're not going to build so many affordable housing that one day you'll look up and all of these houses will be empty because people have moved. That's a fairy tale.
Right.
That's a fairy tale, something that Walt Disney ought to write rather than urban planners. The issue here then is fix these houses, raise the quality while simultaneously lowering the rent. And that's the challenges that we're facing. The final part of that is I call these houses a Trojan horse for gentrification because they will be pulling in large numbers of whites. I had a developer tell me, and this was an African-American developer, that he was building affordable housing around in the Broadway area specifically so that they could attract a significant number of whites along with blacks. A significant number of whites along with blacks. And I'm saying this is because these are the kinds of tactics and strategies that are being used to impact negatively on the African-American community on Buffalo's East Side, rather than saying we have a serious problem, how can we solve it?
You did touch upon it when you made the anecdote about the developer that I talked to, but you did mention how Broadway Fillmore area in the city of Buffalo, from what you understand, is the prime development or prime spot for what will become gentrification in the city of Buffalo. Can you share other pieces of information that lead you to that conclusion?
Yeah. One of the ironies is that this was also an area that is where economic hardship is at the highest levels. Most of the East Side neighborhoods that have the highest what we call hardship indexes are in or near the Broadway Fillmore area. So there's a lot of hardship in that community, but it's also a community with vast levels of vacant land. It's near downtown Buffalo, and it is anchored by a major site, and that would be the Central Terminal.
Right.
So it has this magnificent artifact that can be used as a stimulus for housing and economic development, and its proximity to downtown makes it a prime target. So the mayor of Buffalo instituted one of their redevelopment strategies in that area. I think that might have been the Adams Street project, somewhere near Genesee and Broadway, which is essentially a homeowner model with the idea that you develop homeownership and that will trigger other forms and other types of development. We see the flooding of that area with these affordable apartment units. And we are also seeing property values increase in those locations, as well as the percentage of whites and individuals with college degrees occurring in those locations and spaces. And so that's the kind of data that triggers our belief that this is a major site of gentrification in the city of Buffalo, although it is at its very nascent stages of development.
Just curious, like you said, you see this coming. You see the seeds being sown, they're being fertilized, and the gentrification will follow if this path is continued. What could be done to stop that right now and find a way to continue to move forward?
Following the release of The Harder We Run, my team began to notice significant levels of development occurring on the Buffalo's east side. Based on our count, which is based on a report that was released by Business First, you got something around $2 to $3 billion of projects that are either occurring or projects that are planned and hope to be implemented sometime in the future. So we begin to think of what kind of model of neighborhood development could we create that would change the trajectory of development on Buffalo's east side. We believe that the existing model that was being used was not one that would lead to fruitful results for the African-American community. And based on our analysis of Black communities all over the country, including places like Atlanta, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland, we were convinced that these approaches would ultimately lead to the displacement of the African-American community. So we took a step back and we tried to understand how the processes of building the city contributed to the underdevelopment of the African-American community. And we forged a strategy of developing what we called an alternative model that was based upon five principles: community control, shared ownership, cooperative economics, solidarity, and community wealth production. That these five principles would anchor this process of development. A central part of that was to confront the issue of how do we use the redevelopment and the transformation of a community to empower folks and to provide them the skills to earn a living within this metropolitan region. So we wanted to create a project where, one, we integrated planning and implementation. In other words, rather than planning and then later on development, we were going to plan and develop at the same time. Most significantly, we were going to develop an innovative training program based on the job training so that people would acquire the skills that would enable them to rebuild their neighborhoods and rebuild their lives simultaneously. Now, this idea and notion came from our observation that the East Side had been turned into a job market for white people. I want to repeat that.
Right.
That the East Side had been turned into a job market for white people. So when we talk about the Kensington Project, a $1 billion project, we raised the question, two questions. One was, why are white people in suburban communities celebrating, popping champagne and lighting up cigars? Then we raised the question, who will get those jobs? Who will get those contracts? And we concluded that the overwhelming majority of people getting those jobs and contracts were going to be white. Even Mayor Brown admitted that, which meant that that billion of dollars would flow through the East Side like water through a sieve. Then we looked across the East Side, even in the African-American Heritage Corridor. Most of the work, the physical work, was being done by white people. You walk down the east side streets and you see people fixing sidewalks and installing pipes or even cutting the grass. They're mostly white folks. So we said, why don't we train black people? And this is something, by the way, we've been talking about for decades.
Sure.
So it's not a new idea.
But it's how you do it.
Yeah. Train them while they're doing the work. And let's avoid the kind of fiasco that the Northland Training Center has created. We're not going to give people a test to see if they can be tested. We give them the skills they need to do the work. You don't have to be a mathematician. You don't know math? We'll teach you the math that's required to do this job. You don't know how to read? We'll teach you to read what you need to read to do these jobs. Tailor skill development to the requirements of a job. So that requires a new type of job training program. But in this city and across the nation, we have people who can do that. So that's what we mean by a new model, a model that is based upon seriously making the decision and the choices. So with shared ownership, a lot of people say, shared ownership? What are you talking about? Cooperatives? What are you talking about? And we said, what is the most successful institution in the black community? The church. That's a co-op. I will repeat it. The church is a co-op. It's people pooling their resources and planning and developing based on unity around a singular goal. Why can't we upscale that model in a non-secular way? So that in a secular way, so that we are now pooling our resources to buy property, pooling our resources to develop commercial establishment, building and developing co-ops. Co-ops can't work. Ask the people at Lexington Co-op.
Right.
Tell them it doesn't work.
Dr. Taylor, your report, of course, is How We Change the Black East Side. We've really only scratched the surface in some ways, and we're not going to be able to cover all the points, but you've talked about community control via land trusts. We know about the Fruit Belt land trust. Is that the model, or does that model need to be modified as we move forward, what you're talking about here?
The community land trust is one of the models. I think there were problems from the very beginning in the design and the construction of the Fruit Belt community land trust. And so we've learned from that particular experience. And so we plan to use the lands trust as a way of moving property ownership from private and public control to social control. Right now, the city of Buffalo has a land bank, but the purpose of that land bank is to move publicly owned property to privately owned hands. And so one of the ways that we can control market dynamics is through the control of ownership of the land via community land trust. And that means that the people who live in that community will own that land, and they can lease it and they can use it for other means. But it will allow us to both reduce the cost of the ownership of condominiums and other types of things. It will also allow us to acquire commercial properties that we can use for commercial and business development. So the land trust is a critical aspect and a critical part of the abilities to control development in a neighborhood. Also, the importance and the significance of the government willing to transfer ownership of the large swaths of vacant lots that it owns to a community land trust. So we think that that's one and critical parts of the challenge that we face. The other thing that I wanted to say is that we recognize that the Black community face multiple problems. Now, when we analyze these problems, they're not layered one on top of the other, but they're interrelated and interactive. And so we believe if you attack one problem, you begin to trigger solutions across the board. So we're talking about a handful of problems that generate all kinds of issues. So many are behavior problems and other issues, for example, are caused by hardships, the lack of hope and possibility. Much of the violence in our neighborhoods and communities and crime in our neighborhoods and community are generated by young people without a sense of hope and possibilities for the future. And let me say this. The criminals that exist in the Black community are low-income guys. These are not big-time kingpins. They're little low-income folks who have low-paid jobs with high risk. That's what a criminal is, that break into somebody's house. Mm-hmm. And so if we change that reality, we can attack those types of issues. So the assessment of the multitude of problems we face are interrelated and interlocked and stem from a sense of hopelessness and lack of a future that will be better than the past that they've held. So based on our past experiences, we've seen what happens when hope is ignited. Look at the Nation of Islam in its heyday. Its members were drawn from the street. The Black Liberation Movement back in the day with the Panther Party and many other groups, their strength was drawn from that. When I was a kid and we had a chapter of the Black Workers' Congress in Buffalo, we had members in every gang in the city of Buffalo working to transform them. So we know what the past have yielded. So how do we bring that into the future? So a lot of this centers around the development of the neighborhood. And because of this, we're going through an enormous effort to select the site for this demonstration project.
How, when you talk about a neighborhood, is it already a predetermined neighborhood? How, in terms of maybe boundaries, anything you want to just describe what type of community or portion of the community you're maybe focusing on here?
Well, we don't know yet.
Okay.
There is no pre-selected neighborhood. We're using the census tract as a surrogate for the neighborhood. And in using the census tract as a surrogate for the neighborhood, we're talking about over 32 neighborhoods. Mm. On Buffalo's east side. So we've set up a process for doing this. We've put together a team of about 12 to 13 people from across the Buffalo's east side and the city to help make this choice and decision. My team has developed a hardship index that's based on about 8 different variables, including poverty, unemployment, and the like. And on the basis of this index, we've been able to rank order every neighborhood on Buffalo's east side. So we will probably select about the top 5 or 6 neighborhoods that appear on this index. And then we'll have a couple of at-large neighborhoods that we select that may not have a high hardship index, but that other members feel might be key and critical. Once this 6 or 7 neighborhoods are selected, our team will do deep dives into each of these neighborhoods. We'll hold focus groups where we talk to the people. Our team of organizers will do field observations. We'll look at the magnitude and levels of existing developments that are occurring in each of these tracts. We'll do a detailed demographic analysis and the like. And from these, we'll develop profiles on all neighborhoods. Then we'll have a panel of community residents from across the city, not across the city, across the east side, give us their ideas and thoughts about which team is the site will be the best. And then on the basis of that, our admin team will make a final selection. We're looking at several variables that will guide that direction. Number one, the level of hardship that exists in the neighborhood. Number two, where it's located, particularly neighborhoods in or near what we call the gentrification danger zone,
okay,
will have high priority. Those neighborhoods are important because we want to create a firewall between the gentrification areas and those less vulnerable neighborhoods on Buffalo's east side, so that we can begin to develop an alternate model of development in those locations and places. Third is that we want to look at just the readiness of people to drive that change, because when we say we, that's what we mean, we. We talk about these changes. That means that if there's a city hall meeting, we want to be able to bring 5,000 to 10,000 people into that hall, so that the legislators and others will know that this is not just a handful of people, but these are the masses working on these particular types of changes. So the readiness of the neighborhood folks is an important consideration. Then finally, the level of internal organization within that community.
Okay.
How many block clubs, the level of informal organizations and groups. Does it have a singular or a couple of highly developed community organizations that could serve as the lead organizations for our efforts? So those will be the four variables that we're looking at. So we're looking at about an 8 or 9 month process.
Okay.
Just to select the neighborhood where we're working. Then we'll be in the process, we'll be beginning to look for the resources to implement it. We're looking at probably a budget of around $1 million a year over a 5-year period. And that $1 million would be used to put together what we call the A-team. Consisting of planners and developers who will be working closely with us. We know that we're going to have to leverage millions upon millions or more dollars in order to actually do the work. But we think we can do that if we've got the appropriate type of A team in place.
And that will do it for Producers Picks. We thank our guests, Alex Burgos and Dr. Henry Louis Taylor Jr. If you missed anything or want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Thomas O'Neill White. Thanks for listening.